Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, this is Rabbi Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you again to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows represent our desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. And we invite you to share comments and ideas with us at Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or on the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. And our first segment, we want to welcome three very, very distinguished guests, Rabbi Peter Grumbacher, Pastor David Mueller, and Sister Jean Cashman, who are going to discuss a revolution that they're carrying out in the great state of Delaware about education and adult education. Hi, guys. How are you? Welcome to Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having
Thank you. Good morning.
David,
thanks
Jean,
for having us.
Jean, how are you? How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm okay on this first day of spring here in the Philadelphia area as we're getting ready for a balmy 80 degrees sunny day punctuated by snow.
And yeah.
So Peter's in studio and David and Jean are calling in. So about 4 years ago, Peter, you guys got together and began teaching a class. I think the first class was called A Pastor, A Nun, and A Rabbi Walk Into, correct?
Right. That's the first one.
So what's this class about? How did it get started? And the why of this?
Well, I'll let one of my colleagues tell you exactly how we met, but it got started because we were asked if we were interested in teaching a course at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. And, you know, even though we don't like each other very much, we decided that it would be a good idea. And it's really the relationship that we have that makes the class. You know, we're told that we act foolishly, which sort of gives it the personality. And so we decided that we were going to do some kind of interreligious program based upon, you know, our traditions. And the first time we had about 200 people who registered for the class, and the numbers of, you know, have been very good. They haven't been, you know, 200 people already bored with us, but it's been going well.
So, Sister Jean, how do you guys meet? What brought you together? I mean, did you just literally just hang out at a deli or just walk into each other at the Amtrak station in Wilmington? How come?
Not exactly. I think the two guys knew each other before, but I joined the group in the early 80s. I was working for the Catholic Diocese, and I read in the paper one morning that a group of non-Catholic clerics had gone to downtown Wilmington and painted over anti-Catholic graffiti on one of the buildings there. And I thought that was a really nice gesture, and so I took it upon myself to write thank you notes to each of them. There were four pastors named David and the rabbi named Peter, which struck me as soon as I read the names. But the three of
role
us.
Role reversal.
Excuse me?
It was role reversal, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Name reversal, anyway.
Yeah. But the three of us met. We were on a kind of a committee together that met once a month. And that was the beginning of. I didn't know till just now when Peter said that we weren't very good friends. I thought we were. No, he was only kidding. The beginning of a very good and strong friendship and working relationship. And, you know, we've gotten to know each other's families and into events together. And it's a very valuable part of my life, our relationship. And I think on their days when they're not kidding, they might agree.
David, the Osher Institute, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute of the University of Delaware is where you teach this class. Is it every semester, once a year? Just get the details of this. And if somebody really wants to follow up on this, how do they do that?
Well, we started, as Peter suggested, 4 years ago. This is the fourth year we're teaching. And we teach each spring semester. We have not been inclined to go beyond that, and this seems to be the best for the three of us and for those who sign up. It is for people 55 and older. One does not have to live in Delaware. I know we have plenty of Pennsylvania people, and I'm not sure, but New Jersey people, I'm sure, would be welcomed as well. There is a fee, and it's paid each semester, and you can take as many as five courses once you pay the fee. You don't have to, but you can. So, and there are a variety, 200 different courses that you can choose from. It's an excellent, excellent program, and we are privileged to be a part of it.
What's the greatest, Peter, what's the best, what's the most important thing that you can elucidate that you've learned from this collaboration and teaching? What's been the highlight? What's the thing that really, you know, gives you that juice?
Based on the reaction of the people who come to the class, it's our relationship that sort of proves that people of different faiths and cultures and what have you are able to get along, and that we understand each other better. I think that's sort of like rubbed off on the class, because I think their level of appreciation of other people, has really grown. That's what they've told us. And David and I just returned from our third interfaith trip to Israel and Jordan, and we had a really good time. And there were people of various faiths who joined us.
The people who signed up for the trip, were they students of you, or former students from the class, or general?
Well, about
never
2 years
ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago, we decided that we were going to attempt this interfaith trip, and people signed up for it. We had two pages of legal pad, single spaced, with people who were interested. It turned out that there were only, I think, six people from the class who joined, but we had people who came from different churches and different synagogues.
David, how many weeks is a class?
13, a typical semester.
Okay.
This year has been disrupted by weather and a few other things. Our trip took Peter and me away for 2 weeks, and Sister Jean managed it while we were gone quite well, I hear.
From me, he heard that.
So you've had some unbelievable titles. A pastor and a nun and a rabbi walk into Have Your People Call My People and the Truth According to the God Squad. Let me just throw this out to the three of you. Peter mentioned that the strength of the class has really been the interplay and the relationships. But stepping back after 3 years now in your fourth year of teaching about this, let me ask each one of you, what is the one thing that you've learned and appreciate the most as a result of this interplay and this class? Jean, let me start with you.
Okay, I think one of the things that I learn every week in class is that, there are a lot of people out there who know nothing about the denominations, which they do not practice. And then there are people who know a lot, and they are beginning to open up to us and say, well, I had this neighbor who's a Buddhist, and I really didn't, have much to do with her. So I think that's the thing that really keeps me going, that people are more open than, the news often portrays them. And not everybody, but, I think that we have seen people kind of come out this year's class, especially because we have more interaction with the students than in past years, which we designed. And, people are being very open about their lack of knowledge and lack of understanding of others, but very willing to find out. So they've responded really well, and that keeps me going.
I think there are people who don't know much about the denomination they belong to,
mm-hmm.
as well. But this year the class is called America's Got Religion. And the difference is that just about every week we invite someone else to join us. And who are, for example, last week we had the Orthodox rabbi who came. And every week we have a different question that the three of us answer. And he in this particular case, answered the question as well. So tomorrow, if we have class because of the snow, we have a Unitarian Universalist who's going to be joining us. Sister Jean, you had, who was there when you were there by yourself?
A Hindu.
So we're learning.
And
about,
he invited people to come visit his temple, and I have a long list of people who want to go and tour the Hindu temple who have never, you know, thought they would ever do something like that.
And I believe in this climate that we are in this country politically and to a large extent spiritually or religiously as well. There is something to be said for a safe environment, and we believe we're providing that to get to know people. There's a thirst for doing that, not on the parts of all, but especially the generation of people that we serve who are over 55 and are maybe tired of fighting and disagreeing, would like to get down and learn some positive things about people who are different from them.
Well, David, you open up the door to a conversation that I wanted to take us to anyway, and that is your demographic in the class are older adults, the 55 and over, the AARP generation. I would imagine you have a significant number of boomers and aging boomers in there. And I'm sure I would assume, and you'll tell me if I'm wrong, that in part of the conversation, either in class or amongst yourselves, that you reflect upon this shift that you alluded to, David, in religious observance, certainly as a result of the Pew studies, the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, the people who really have no religious identification in the United States. What's your take to this shift? Are you in Americans' religious persuasion? Because we're being told, at one hand, there's less of a religiosity in the country. And on the other hand, the other articles are saying, no, there's a rise in this. It's just very, very different than it was when we were growing up. Do you handle this in class?
We try. We try. There are a lot of things being written about that. My hunch is that you get pendulum swings. We've seen them before. And we don't know what it's going to swing back toward. The world seems to be divided, at least our American world, between evangelicals and others. One of the people we're having in another couple of weeks is an evangelical from Wilmington. And those kinds of conversations often don't happen, and we're happy to provide them because the evangelicals are experiencing a whittling away at their young people as well. It's universal, and it crosses not just denominational lines, but religious lines, Jewish, Christian, and other.
Do you see other examples of inter-religious cooperation in academic circles like this, or are you guys so unique to your knowledge?
I'm sure there are other groups that have this kind of thing. Originally, we were very active in the National Conference of Christians and Jews, which was a phenomenal organization, which I don't believe exists. And if it does exist, it's just the shell of what it used to be. And through that, we were able to accomplish a great deal in Wilmington secularly. It was through our initiative that we got cooperation when we had desegregation. And even the city fathers and mothers agreed that it was because of our push that created a safe environment for the desegregation of the schools. So that is, in a sense, missing nowadays. We just don't have it anymore. And I think that the three of us feel that what was could be again, but it's going to have to be in a much smaller, kind of a ratio, because we're doing the best we can. But as far as I know, I don't know other group that's doing stuff. They might be talking, but I'm not so sure they're doing. I think Sister Jean is part of the state interfaith program.
Yeah, the last governor appointed an advisory council on faith-based partnerships, and it has 12 members who are from the wide spectrum of interfaith organizations. And truthfully, we've spent like 3 years trying to figure out what our best role is while doing some things, haven't we? We've had some public forums discussing interfaith issues, and we've also done some hands-on things together as an interfaith group. And the current, we have had several meetings with the current governor. He's not sure how he wants to use us, but the latest thing we are getting a start on is the violence and poverty in Wilmington, in the city of Wilmington. And he wants a very clear interfaith participation in the solution to, you know, those major problems. So that's what we'll be working on this year. But, you know, it takes all of us to, you know, put something like that together to really be effective. And I'm sure we can be, but I think we need to stop talking and get out there and get our hands dirty.
I'm anxious.
I would add to that simply that one of the things I look back upon with shame almost is that the community that I serve, the Lutheran community that I served for 30 years, we tried, but we did not try hard enough to let the congregation itself be a safe place where conversations about absolutely anything could take place. I think the church needs to be that. I would presume the synagogue needs to be that, and any other religious institution. And we failed in that regard, I think. And that's a part of the reason why I think we've seen exodus on the parts of people who leave. We don't matter to them.
Well, we could have mattered
if we'd have done some things differently.
Well, let me ask you a question, because this is a conversation that happens within the rabbinate as well now, especially with the shift in generations. Do you think part of that is because religious leaders, ministers, rabbis, our imams are so concerned about membership and the bottom line of the church or the synagogue's finances that they're a little bit more hesitant to take a stand and make that institution a safe place, even though having to do that may raise some very controversial issues? And is it a lot easier just to go with the flow and not rock the boat because, you know, who knows, I may offend a member? Because I know this is a conversation that comes up quietly.
My personal reaction to that, Rabbi, is that for too long, institutionalized religion has been too damn careful. We are not willing to take risks to step out and speak up where we need to be speaking up and saying the things that nobody else is going to say, but we need to be saying them. And it's almost like, I say this to Christians, that it's almost like there were 9 Beatitudes, and one of them was, blessed are the careful, you know, for they will not lose anything. And, you know, I think that's a terrible stand for any religious group, and I think we should be on the forefront of, you know, stepping out there and saying the hard things and doing the hard things and getting things changed. You know, we've been very good at making small changes here and there, but what we really need is change, not changes. And
we've been more haven than leaven, I think. The coming in and having a nice place, perhaps not safe in the ways we used it before, but a nice place to contend with your life and your issues, but not to go too far beyond that. And I think another dynamic in terms of the present world is there's 1,000 more distractions to especially young people than we had when we were their age, and cutting through all of that, those distractions to find some meaning is something that we need to discover how to do better.
I think it's the political atmosphere in this country also that has created this, in a sense, clergy and members being extremely careful and fearful, you know, that anything that they say, you know, might be held against them. And I think also social media plays a role in this as well. You never know exactly what the response is going to be from your own membership, from people in the community, and unfortunately, you get people on the fringes, you know, who might have a a negative response. And with the violence going on nowadays, you never know what's going to happen. I think the country is in a bad situation now, and that's impacting on religion. Ironically, it's the synagogues and churches and mosques that should be the place where people can feel as if not only that they're safe to talk, but, you know, safe in terms of, you know, just their psyche and their emotion and their ability to, you know, to one place in their world that they can come to and feel as if they can let go emotionally. But
I would say amen to that.
Mm-hmm. And me too.
Do you think Peter, we've talked a little bit about this at the various diners in South Jersey, but I'm actually to you guys' reactions. I mean, you seem to allude to the fact that institutional religion right now is so careful, as Gene is talking about the beatitude of carefulness, that we've succumbed to the fact that when people come to us, we just want to make them feel good because life out there is so crazy. They just want to be, we just don't bother me. Just let me feel good. Sing me a nice song. Make it nice. Not too long, but make it nice. And don't bother me. This, from what I'm hearing you say, and I happen to agree with it, is really dangerous, isn't it? The irrelevance factor is growing.
Exactly. What we're doing is we're taking our core values and putting them on hold, you know, at best, if we're not tossing them out. I mean, you and I know that social justice has been the basis of Reform Judaism, mm-hmm. you know, since its inception. And I'm wondering whether or not the programs and ideology of social justice is, as I said, being put on hold. Because you never know how your congregants are going to feel. There's such a disparity of opinion and that's impacting on the values that we hold dear. So therefore, it's safer to be safe. It's safer to be neutral. And in a sense, that's working against us mm-hmm. because I think people feel if you have nothing to cling to, if you have none of those values, then you're no different than anything else outside of the synagogue.
Let me ask you.
I would go a step further and beyond carefulness and say we're fearful. And I would include myself in that. I am a believer that faith and fear cannot occupy the same heart at the same time. And faithfulness allows you to get out into social justice issues and into the community and outside of your own little bailiwick of issues and provide some effective and hopefully meaningful assistance and help. Fearfulness will always keep you under the pew or under the altar or wherever other piece of furniture you can find to hide. And I believe we've been far too fearful and need to return to being faithful.
I was speaking to a colleague of Richard's and mine this weekend, and interestingly, he said the one thing that's missing that we desperately need is hope, and that the synagogue is not a source of hope now, and it must return to that.
Let me ask you a question, the three of you, before we start running out of time for this segment. The classes that you teach over those last 4 years, probably hundreds and hundreds of people have walked through those doors and been influenced by you. The over 55 crowd that you're dealing with, what are they looking for? I know they're coming for the education and a wonderful class and your reputation, but when you remove that off the surface, the three of you have enough practical real world experience. What are they looking for in their life that's driving them to this class?
Maybe they're looking for meaning. Maybe they're trying to find it not so much in different religions, that is to say, to adopt them, but rather to see that there is meaning in interaction, that there's meaning in working together. I don't know. It's difficult to say.
Richard, I've thought of that occasionally because many of the people in our class have been there for 4 years, believe it or not. We have a lot of repeats. And I'm always teasing that they couldn't possibly be coming for the jokes because the jokes are not that funny.
Come on, give me a break.
Yes, they are.
and they're often the same ones. But I think that they, in their own ways, are liking the message that we bring. And I don't think we we exude fear. I think what we exude is that things are possible, you know, and it is possible to work together and achieve something. And I kind of think that I think that's what brings people back. Recently, I had a woman in the class apologize that this is the first year she's been there. I'm not like the others, she said. I haven't taken your course every year. But, you know, it's like it's a requirement or something. But I think they really are looking for people like the three of us who, well, maybe because we're aging ourselves and have nothing to lose, but I think that's not it. I think that we are not really stymied by fear and are willing to express what we think within, you know, maybe some limits. And I think that people get a message from us that, you know, it doesn't matter on some levels who you are and what you believe, you can still work together and, you know, do something for
the three of us.
Nowhere. One at a time. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I have a Bible verse. It's Romans 8 or 12:18. If it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live at peace with everybody. And I go by that. And my hunch is that people are looking, among other things, for peace, just a little peace, even if it comes with some challenges of talking about some things that can get very difficult.
Peter, why don't you just finish it up as we end this segment? Go ahead.
I think people realize that the three of us didn't come together one day and say, let's do a class, and we didn't know each other. You know, we come from different backgrounds, but it's friendship that goes well above, you know, our religious perspectives. And I think I've heard a number of people say, this is really, really amazing that the three of you, you know, can be friends. I mean, Gene and I blessed Day's daughter at her wedding.
Mm-hmm.
We've come to each other's life cycle events. So it's not, you know, it's not coming out of nowhere. And I think people appreciate that and are looking to make connections.
Rabbi Peter Grumbacher, Pastor David Mueller, and Sister Jean Cashman, thank you very much for sharing your ideas, this wonderful class that you're teaching at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute of the University of Delaware. Continued good luck this semester. And continued spreading the word about, as you started this, guys, in the power of relationships, just simple human relationships, and getting to know each other and sitting down and understanding each other and how that can overcome just about every barrier that we have. And the more, the merrier in today's world.
Thanks for inviting us.
So thank you very, very,
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
Take care. Good luck. Drive safe in the weather. And we'll be right back with our second guest right after this musical interlude.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Volunteer Strategies is an organization out of Denver, Colorado, that really works with this overwhelming new revolution in volunteerism. And the head of that, the president of that, is Beth Steinhorn, who is joining us now from Denver. Beth, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Rabbi. Thanks for having me on today.
So tell me about Volunteer Strategies. What is it? How did it get started? And what do you hope to do with it?
Sure. VQ Volunteer Strategies is, as you mentioned, a Denver-based firm, but we work throughout the U.S. and Canada with organizations of all different types, helping them to increase their impact through strategic volunteer engagement. We really believe that every organization, nonprofits, faith-based organizations, government entities, that they all have a natural, what we call a VQ, a volunteer quotient, but that through best practices in engaging volunteers, they can raise that VQ, that score, and achieve smarter and increased impact. While our company recently went through a name change, we just rebranded last fall, October of 2017, the company had been around since 2003. It was previously known as J.S. Fixler Group, founded by a woman named Jill Freeman Fixler. I joined the firm in 2007, and when she retired in 2013, took over, and along with my partner, Linda, and we just really love working with organizations to help them leverage volunteer talent and steward human capital in the same way that they strive to steward financial resources. Because while financial resources are limited, human capital, talent, the gifts of skills and time and passion are really an abundant resource if you tap them strategically. So that's what we strive to help all organizations achieve.
You mentioned in some of our conversation that baby boomers were the first to, quote, shift the paradigm of volunteerism, unquote. What does that mean?
Well, if you think about our nonprofit sector in the United States and Canada as well, you know, so much of our current sector, nonprofit organizations, Jewish and otherwise, were founded by and for greatest generation volunteers, you know, mid-20th century, who were motivated to volunteer out of a sense of loyalty and duty, and for decades religiously showed up, you know, every Tuesday from 1 to 4 to take on their volunteer shift, whether it was at a museum or work their way up the proverbial volunteer ladder to reach that pinnacle of being on a committee or getting on the board. And yet that isn't what motivates most boomers in terms of their volunteerism. Boomers, you know, as the saying often goes, you know, work to change the world in the 60s, and now that they've reached their 60s and beyond, are really working to leave a social legacy, yet are demanding a different way to serve than prior generations. They are not available every Tuesday, 1 to 4 p.m., to show up and fill the same role for 20 years till they earn their 20-year pin or a big certificate. Instead, they really have reimagined retirement, and in doing so, believed that and still believe that volunteering is really integral to that vision of retirement, yet have a different expectation around what they do with their volunteering. They demand flexible schedules. They really want to know the impact that they're having, because they're there not just to affiliate and meet other people, which is a very valid reason, but they also have for a long time been very clear on what would make volunteering appealing, and that is the chance to use their skills. So boomers were the first generation, even though people often think it was millennials who did this, it really is boomers who were the first to approach nonprofits and say, you know, I want to use my skills, I want to make a difference, I want to volunteer with you, but if you can't meet my desires, if you can't tell me the impact that I'll have, if you can't train me with new skills or give me a chance to use my professional skills, I'm going to take my time and skills and go elsewhere.
So Beth, how have organizations had to change to meet this new volunteer profile?
Well, sadly, some haven't, and they're obviously struggling, but those who have really have done so by thinking about volunteer roles beyond, we kind of think of that an org chart, typical org chart, where volunteers have traditionally served at the top in governance roles on boards and committees, or at that bottom in direct service roles, perhaps as tutors, as drivers for human service organizations, taking people to medical appointments, for example, or in delivering meals, et cetera. Instead, the organizations that have really succeeded have shifted beyond seeing volunteers just at the top or at the bottom and are filling in that hearty middle with roles that are truly strategic for Boomer volunteers to take on as leaders of projects, as leaders of teams, thinking beyond traditional committees, which for many boomers and younger generations is a word that's synonymous with life sentence, right? You're on a committee, you meet every Wednesday, and you're on it for years on end. But when you're on a team, you have a defined beginning, middle, end. There's a role that has a shared goal for the team, and boomers are great leaders of teams, sharing their professional skills and working side by side with staff to build their capacity. So those are some of the ways, whether they're working on projects, initiatives, events. It really comes down to organizations think more broadly about what are their true organizational needs and where do some of those needs align with boomers' skills, abilities, and interests, and where there's overlap, they create new strategic roles for volunteers to fill. But it takes a different type of staff person. Go ahead.
Now, there's been a significant number of articles on a regular basis about the impact of and the need for social contact in people once they leave full-time work. And obviously, could you just speak to the intended and sometimes maybe unintended consequence of volunteering and getting back into a social network situation as opposed to being in isolation, which is a death sentence in many cases?
Sure. Well, first of all, there's lots of research that shows that health benefits are absolutely correlated with volunteering. Individuals who volunteer are healthier. They have less stress. They have a sense of purpose. They have self-confidence, physical and mental activity. It's decreased risk of depression, et cetera. Plus, obviously, people are living longer, and many, many boomers are looking not just at the health benefits, but also reaping professional and social benefits, as you alluded to, by volunteering. Organizations like Encore.org, which were founded right as the first boomers were enter their 60s about 12 years ago, organizations like Encore are really founded on to leverage this trend that boomers are not viewing retirement as their end of their professional career. Boomers view retirement as a chance to start their Encore career. So many boomers are volunteering, working in U.S. national service programs like AmeriCorps volunteers and getting training in new professions. Others are working part-time or using volunteering as a way to build up their resume to make a transition for an Encore career in the nonprofit arena. So both health and social and thirdly, professional benefits are really there for the tapping for those who can find the right opportunity.
Have you seen in your work in volunteer strategies, and again, we're talking to volunteer strategies president Beth Steinhorn from Denver, have you seen this desire to perhaps on the part of boomers, especially who will leave full-time work, they'll volunteer, and all of a sudden that volunteerism will become a second career?
Absolutely. Yes, I have seen. I just interviewed a woman yesterday on behalf of a client, actually, who, when I asked how long she'd been with this organization, she said, I was with one organization for 38 years, and then I came here, I retired, and I came here to volunteer, and, you know, within a year, they actually offered me a position, and I couldn't turn it down because I really believe in the work and knew that this was a three-year initiative that I could make a difference with. And so, yes, I just spoke with one yesterday. I assume doing the math, she probably was a boomer. I didn't ask her age. And we see that as well, you know, as a consultant and a leader and proponent of volunteer engagement, I don't believe that the end goal of volunteering should be getting hired. I think that volunteering in and of itself is a valuable end to shoot for, but there are times when that really is best for both the individual and for the organization.
Do you find any aspect of ageism with companies and organizations dealing with the bringing on as volunteers of boomers or older adults? Because, you know, we want to paint this picture that this is, everything's rosy and my God, everybody's waiting to take that 78-year-old person and have them volunteer. I think they just made, it was a movie, a Robert De Niro and Hathaway movie about a year and a half ago.
The
about
Intern, I think.
The Intern,
like that.
The Intern. Yeah. Another fantasy product of Hollywood. But do you still see aspects of ageism in the work that you're doing? And if so, how do you get around it?
It's an interesting question. So I would say that it's an exception rather than the rule in my experience. Of course, those mm-hmm. with whom I work, it's a self-selecting group of, you know, workshop participants and clients who obviously have a bigger vision of volunteer engagement. It's interesting. I think the reason why I'm pausing is because for many of the organizations I've worked with, like hospitals and some cultural institutions, frankly, many would be thrilled to have more boomer volunteers as they are significantly younger than some of the other volunteers that make up their volunteer corps, aging, greatest, and silent generation volunteers. So some are starting with or average ages of their volunteer corps, you know, in the late 70s and 80s, to move down into boomers in early 70s, 60s, and late 50s would be a welcome shift. Having said that, I think that as we look at increased skills-based roles, like pro bono consultants and leaders of initiatives, not just in direct service, there is a challenge, especially when you have younger staff members, millennials, younger Xers, who are having to supervise up to older volunteers. That's definitely, whether it's pure ageism or just challenging intergenerational potential conflicts and stereotypes, that's absolutely something we see in many, many different organizations, that generational conflict in both directions. Boomers and older volunteers often also ask about staff members ask them, how can we engage those millennials? And they have stereotypes about millennials. So we do a lot of work with organizations around how to cultivate and nurture cross-generational teams, multi-generational teams, staff and volunteers. And organizations need skills and training in that. It isn't easy. There are a lot of stereotypes. So it's something I do see, sadly, in both directions.
Well, you mentioned the word training. I'm just wondering, with this explosion in boomer volunteerism and the change in the nature of the baby boomer as a volunteer, the flexibility of schedule, the juggling of family, grandchildren, et cetera, mm-hmm. travel, do you provide, does Volunteer Strategies work with a company and actually provide any training on here's how the care and feeding of your new type of volunteer?
Absolutely. Our company, VQ Volunteer Strategies, works across the country. We provide training virtually. We have organizations that often bring me out to do trainings and lead workshops. And we work, there is an entire sector of volunteer engagement with which we're heavily integrated through Points of Light Institute, through the America's Service Commissions. There's a large network of individuals in the Jewish world and beyond who are actively seeking professional development in volunteer engagement skills and competency. And that's something we really love to do. It balances out our longer-term consulting work, but it's a way to keep fresh and hear what are the trends, the challenges, the pain points among those who are working in organizations that rely on volunteer contributions, volunteer work, to achieve their missions. And that goes for organizations that have staff members with the title volunteer coordinator and those that don't. And most synagogues, for example, don't have a dedicated volunteer coordinator. They may have a member manager, but it's a shared responsibility. So where I see the biggest challenges are in organizations that engage and rely on volunteers but don't necessarily have somebody dedicated to learning these best practices. But it's definitely out there, and we provide a lot of training. Go ahead.
So in your experience working with the volunteers and working with boomers who are entering this field, what are the top three areas that that people want to volunteer? What are the top three places that the boomer volunteers seem to be wanting to be involved with?
Good question. Definitely, about 8-10 years ago, a big issue, of course, was healthcare. Lots of boomers were very interested in helping to connect individuals, whether they be new immigrants or low-income families, to good health services. And here in Colorado, we have a couple different programs specifically for boomers to help provide that sort of connection, boomers leading health, or boomers leading change in health. I'd say a second issue is education, whether it's tutoring kids or educational advocacy. That has been a big issue for many, many boomers, could even be education reform. A third, I don't have a specific field, but I'd say the third driver of boomer engagement, again, is the chance to be a player in a nonprofit, often in a new one. Many boomers are motivated to kind of tap into their entrepreneurial spirit and help new initiatives get launched and know that they're really leaving a legacy by helping to create something new regardless of the specific issue that it's addressing.
We've been speaking with Beth Steinhorn, the president of Volunteer Strategies out of Denver, Colorado, and really talking, and I thank you, Beth, for enlightening us on this whole, what I call the give back syndrome of a lot of baby boomers who wanted to, now that perhaps leaving full-time work, really find the motivation to give something back of their life and experience to society. So I want to thank you very much for your time and really wish you continued good luck with VQ and appreciate your time with us here this morning on Boomer Generation Radio. So thank you very, very, very much. Take care.
Thanks, Rabbi.
One of the things that we are trying to do on these shows and podcasts is to every once in a while bring some commentary from individuals. We've been blessed to have several regular commentaries by our colleague, Rabbi Jeff Salkin. And we want to welcome a new participant to our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio podcast series today and introduce the former president, immediate past president of the Union for Reform Judaism, Rabbi Eric Yaffe, who is going to start speaking to us, hopefully on a regular basis, about aspects of transition. So, Eric, welcome, and thank you for joining us as part of our commentary section here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio and our podcast.
Hello, my name is Rabbi Eric Yaffe. I welcome you to my podcast, which I call Transitions, Turning Points, and Torah. What I'm going to do in these little talks is reflect on the turning points that we face in life, what it means to be a parent and a grandparent, what it means to stop working or to change the kind of work we do, what it means to grow older, and also what Jewish teachings have to say about these things. Now, I want to begin by talking about power, because the change that I'm referring to always involves issues of power. There are three things to say about power. The first is that so much of our lives is consumed with getting it and exercising it. I spent most of my professional life as a rabbi working for the Union for Reform Judaism. For 16 years, I was president of the URJ, and in that capacity, I met with people who possess real power in our world: foreign ministers, prime ministers, senators, even presidents. I saw how, for these people, the acquisition of power consumed their lives. Getting and using power was their reason for being. But this is not only true for great leaders. I ran a rather large religious organization where questions of power were always in play. Everyone wanted a little more power in their corner of the universe. In fact, almost all of us, whether we're in business or academia or healthcare, are traffickers in power in our professional lives. We all feel that the more power we possess, the more impact we will have and the more significant we will feel. But now the second thing that I have to say about power: how fleeting it is. This is so for truly powerful people, those prime ministers, senators, presidents. They make a difference, but for how long? Soon enough, someone comes along to replace them, does things differently, moves the world in another direction. And when that happens, what is left of the power and influence that they worked for so desperately? And in fact, this applies to us all. When we step down, retire, do things other than what we have been doing for so long, it almost always means the loss of the power we built up over the years. When I stopped being president of the URJ and turned my attention to writing and speaking, the power I had for my job dissipated, just like that. Did I miss it? Sure, for a while. And for a while, I found myself saying, well, if I were still there, I'd be doing this or I'd be doing that. But then, all of a sudden, it hits you. You realize just how fleeting power and influence are, how quickly the world moves on, how your successor is doing just fine, better than you even, with new ideas and new energy. And then something else happens, and this is the third thing that I have to say about power. You realize that the real power and influence you have in the world has nothing to do with your job, but with those closest to you, your family members, those that you love, your spouse, your partner, and in particular, your children. There, what you do is not fleeting, but lasting, permanent. By chance, today is my mother's 20th Yahrzeit. How did my mother, dynamic, loving, both a pioneering Jewish leader and a traditional Jewish mother, how did she influence me, shape me as a person? And the answer is, in every way imaginable. No word that comes out of my mouth and no action that I take is not influenced by who my mother was, what she taught me, and how she raised me. And what is true for me is true for us all. All of us remember words and actions of our parents that made us who we are, that shaped us, not for a moment, but for a lifetime. And what is true for me and my parents is also true for me and my children. Some things I got right with them, instilling pride and confidence in them, and some things I got wrong, creating fears and insecurities. Two final observations. First, Judaism understands this very well. Some people talk dismissively about pediatric religion, but Judaism is proudly pediatric. It is a system for passing along our values, concerns, and love to our children. In a few weeks, we will celebrate Passover. And the great ritual of Passover, the Seder, will be held in our homes and will be built entirely around our children. The youngest child will ask a question, and then the Seder will have one purpose only, to answer that question, transmitting our memories, our history, our values to our kids, who at that moment will be the center of our attention and the focus of our concern. And finally, what does all this mean for me now as a 70-year-old father and grandfather? Well, my children are grown, they're busy adults with impressive accomplishments, and my influence is limited. But still, perhaps I can reinforce at least a little bit through words, example, and a caring presence the lessons and values that I tried to teach them when they were younger. Perhaps I can remind them ever so gently as they pursue careers that I have urged them to pursue, that as important as those careers are, the greatest influence and power they will ever have in their lives will be the influence they have over their children. And perhaps when it comes to my grandson, who is only 6 years old, I can, together with my wife, devote the time to him that I did not always devote to my own children, distracted as I was back then by influence and power of another sort. Because I know now what I was not sufficiently aware of then. Power is central to our lives, but the power that really matters is the love, support, and care that we provide every single day to our family, our children, and those closest to us. This is Rabbi Eric Yaffe. Thank you and shalom.
Thanks, Eric. Thank you very much. We look forward to another commentary in the coming weeks. To all of you, thank you for being part of today's broadcast on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows will be archived as usual as podcasts on Blog Talk Radio and on our website, jewishsacredaging.com. And we again invite your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com or Jewish Sacred Aging Radio on our Facebook. These shows are produced at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and under the supervision of our producer, Steve Lubetkin. We thank you for listening, and we look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. And check out our podcast again on Jewish Sacred Aging, sacredaging.com. Take care. Have a great week. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Take care and shalom.